Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The names bring back memories. Bishops, the Louisiane, Penningtons, the Italian Inn, or Shotgun Sam's, Casa Bonita, or the Metro Diner. Those names conjure vivid images and senses from longtime Tulsans, restaurants that were the site of romantic evenings, celebrations, or family gatherings for several generations. Today, they're all just memories. My guest today was too young to eat or know most of these iconic eateries. But photographer, writer, and Route 66 advocate Reese Martin searched out the families, employees, and friends of over 45 Tulsa restaurants that are gone today to learn the stories about them and the people they served. Lost Restaurants of Tulsa is a new book by Martin that shares the stories of these establishments, plus one that was special to him, the Blue Dome Diner downtown. His story about that reminds us that for all of these restaurants featured in the book, they may be lost, but they're certainly not forgotten. Reese Martin has a signing tonight at 6 o'clock at Ida Red downtown, and a signing that's been rescheduled from Saturday to Monday at 6:30 at the Tulsa Historical Society. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Reese Martin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, restaurants come and go. Anybody in the restaurant business will tell you that. What interested you in telling the story of these old restaurants here in Tulsa that so many people love?
Well, it started with my love of Route 66. I became interested in kind of the Americana history of the 20th century, and I wanted to dig more into Tulsa specifically. I'd always heard stories about places like Bishop's and Pennington's, and it was of interest to me to find out what was the real story, not just about the food on the plate, but about the people, you know, behind the door. And so I've spent the last 2 years researching and meeting with families and learning all these stories.
Was it difficult to find these stories? Because as you well know, restaurant people are sometimes gypsies. They move all around, and you know, a lot of these people have deep roots here in the city, but I would think other stories were probably a little more difficult to find.
Yes, it was. I've compared it to trying to dig for oil. You know, I'd go down all these different areas and find nothing, and go somewhere else and find nothing. But then I would strike gold, and then, you know, Tulsa's a small town, and you get down to it. I'd find one person, they'd say, you know, you should talk to my friend this person, or oh, you should talk to this person. And eventually I started finding names and just cold calling people in other states. And as soon as I told them what I was doing, they'd stay on the phone with me to 2 to 3 hours.
Wow. So you heard some amazing stories.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Now, you're a young guy, so most of these restaurants, you've never eaten at any of them.
Right. Yeah, there's two or three in here I actually ate at.
So which ones have you actually eaten at?
The Metro Diner.
Okay, right.
I had a steak at Eddie's there last week. And the epilogue of the book covers my lost restaurant, which is the Blue Dome Diner downtown.
And the Blue Dome, I remember it from its initial, which was actually just down the street from the university here when it was the Route 66 Diner, Debbie Higgs.
That's right.
Amazing food in this little roadhouse shack on Route 66.
Yeah, and that Route 66 Diner on 11th was originally a Silver Castle, which was a Tulsa chain based started in the 30s. And so all this stuff is connected.
Yeah. You begin the book with the story of Bishop's Restaurant. And I'm too young for Bishop's Restaurant, but I had parents that loved to eat at Bishop's, and it's impossible to overstate the significance for the older generation of what Bishop's meant to a lot of Tulsans. And you give us a sense, this was a truly an institution restaurant that it was pretty much the go-to place in Tulsa for a generation or more.
It absolutely was. Bishop's was called the place to be. You just tell someone, I'll meet you at Bishop's, and you didn't have to say anything else. You had soldiers stationed in the area that listed Bishop's as their mailing address because they were there so often they'd just pick up anything that came in for them. And folks that were in local plays and other performances would go down to Bishop's at 3 a.m. and drink coffee till those first newspapers hit the sidewalk outside so they could read the reviews. It was everything from a quick bite to a fancy meal out with a loved one.
And in a time when Tulsa was very much a small town, this was a 24-hour destination. Yeah. And it was a huge destination. It was multi-levels.
Yeah, and there were several downtown restaurants that were 24 hours at the time. The Mandarin Cafe was just a few blocks down, and you know, I was talking to that family, and when the Douglas Bomber Plant let out at 2 a.m. for their shift change, they'd get slammed with people. But when you mention 24 hours in Tulsa, Bishop's is the first name that come to people's lips.
And for those who've never maybe even heard of Bishop's, why was it so important? What was special about it?
Well, the fact that it was 24 hours and that they served people from all different walks of life. You could go in and get a meal, you know, for a very little amount of money, or you could have a fancy dinner. It was a two-level restaurant. You had a big coffee bar area. You had a nice dining area. And the second floor was a buffeteria for folks that, you know, just needed to get a little bit. So the fact that it catered to all kinds of people and that the food was really good, you know, it's just that's a winning recipe in any era.
Now, it seems like a place like that could become an institution and last forever. What happened?
You had Mr. Bishop, Bill Bishop, passed away in the late 1950s. And then in the 1960s, after Bill Bishop Jr. was deployed overseas, you had the folks running it, which is the Powers family, and the fact that parking on Main Street went away. People were moving to the suburbs. It was just a bunch of different things happened all at once. And they said, you know, I think our time has passed. And it ended up getting demolished for a parking lot. If you think parking in downtown is a problem now, it kind of always has been.
Right, right. Well, that's one of the great old restaurants that you detail in the book, Lost Restaurants of Tulsa. Another one that comes to mind, and this is a place I ate at a couple times, the Denver Grill, although I didn't eat at the original location. This is like a lot of restaurants that you detail. They moved all around. They follow their audience.
They sure did. And that's when people talk to me about the Denver Grill, they're talking about the new Denver Grill, which was built in the 50s.
Which is 3rd and Denver.
Right.
Which is now another parking lot.
Right.
Maybe there's a building there now, I think.
Yeah. You know, when the BOK Center was built, that whole area changed. But the first Denver Grill was actually right next to 1st and Denver. And it was just this little stucco-looking building, very basic, kind of like Ray's Coffee Shop at 15th and Peoria. And it lasted for 20 years before they decided it was time to upgrade. And so you have several restaurants in the book that evolve over time. You know, even though none of the restaurants in this book are around anymore, they all have their own individual stories and their life of their own.
Yeah. And what's also great is you have these wonderful pictures. Was it difficult to find the pictures?
Some of them it was. I can't say enough good things about the Tulsa Historical Society. I worked with the Tulsa World and the University of Tulsa also to get some pictures from various archives. And then the families that I had the opportunity to interview would meet with me and bring these photo albums full of old family pictures, and my eyes lit up like Christmas trees. Just very fortunate to have a lot of resources for.
And a lot of these restaurants were run by individuals or families. That you mentioned the Mandarin Cafe. This was a long tradition of restaurateurs because they had the Mandarin Cafe. As South Tulsa develops, they introduce another sort of institution restaurant, the Pagoda.
That's right. And, I mean, then that story goes all the way back to like Honolulu in 1900 and then to Chicago and then to Okmulgee and all over the place. And when the Mandarin was founded in 1930, you had three or four families that made that a reality. And those families split off and did the Pagoda. Another family went off and did Ming Palace at 21st and Yale. And another family started the Golden Palace at 51st and Peoria, which is still operating today.
Yeah. It's a fun, it's a wonderful story of these families. And I assume this is like a major part of their heritage, a restaurant like the Pagoda or Mandarin Cafe.
Absolutely. And that became my focus, really, once I got into this project, is I wanted to do right by these families that trusted me with their family story and their history. And I'm so pleased with how the book turned out.
What are some of the stories that stuck out to you about some of these family stories?
We talked about the Mandarin and the Pagoda already. I was surprised at just how entrenched that was in the family and how that tradition kept kind of springing up again. One would close, the younger generation would say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to make it our own. You have other connections. The Claybrook family, which was responsible for the Denver Grill, Bud Claybrook went on to run the Silver Castle in the Kendall-Whittier District for many years, and then Claybrook's up in Turley, which was just recently demolished. So really, if I had one takeaway, it was just that there are more connections to these restaurants than people realize.
Now, one story you didn't tell, which is another one like that, is the Lebanese Steakhouses. Those are all sort of families that have moved through, and you know, you had the Eddies and Freddies and everything in between, Jamil's and all that.
Sure.
And I've always heard that most of those families were close relations.
They are. Eddie's is in the book.
Yes.
Jamil's isn't because they're still around, thank goodness.
Oh, yeah.
But you also had Silver Flame, which is part of that family. I have another gentleman in the book, Al Saab, that had a steakhouse at 81st and Memorial back when that was a two-lane road. He was a Lebanese gentleman that ran a steakhouse. And so even though some of the families are related and some of them are not, that's another great Tulsa
tradition.
So
that was a requirement that these restaurants were gone.
Yeah.
My guest today is Reese Martin, a photographer and writer and the author of Lost Restaurants of Tulsa. Beautiful photographs, but also wonderful stories about many of these restaurants that are sort of household names. And you mentioned the Silver Castle a couple times. This is a great story because when you look at a photo of a Silver Castle, the original Silver Castle, your thoughts go to White Castle.
That's right.
There's a reason for that.
There sure is. You know, that was an inspiration for Ike Parkey and James McCollum when they founded Silver Castle in the 1930s. By the time the 1940s rolled around, Mr. McCollum had passed away, and Ike decided he was going to franchise these restaurants out. And so you had these little buildings that they manufactured in Wichita, Kansas, to order to people so that they all looked identical. So if someone wanted to open their own, they could just essentially order everything from the front door to the plates to everything from their company. James McCollum's family later went on to found McCollum's on 11th, which is another one that's in the book. Ike Parkey later went on to do Parkey's, which that restaurant isn't in the book. But, you know, another one where the roots run really deep. And the last Silver Castle was around until the mid-1980s over in Kendall Whittier.
Really? Well, another venerable name is the Italian Inn. People still want to have that wonderful cheese dip that they had. And also a couple of their recipes. I hear people lamenting some of the recipes from the Italian Inn. I knew it on South Lewis, but it's actually started in South downtown.
Right. Yeah. There was a gentleman that opened up the Italian Inn in a converted house on Main Street. That lasted for a while till he decided he was going to go back home to Italy. Another family took it over and eventually moved out on South Lewis. And then when that closed, they moved out to Claremore for a few years. So it's another one of those examples of a restaurant that had multiple lives over its history.
Another thing you point out in the book is that a location will have multiple names too. There's a couple of places like that. For example, the Golden Drumstick. Now, this is part of the Tally's Empire at 11th and Yale, but originally the probably was actually something before the Golden Drumstick, if we were clear. I'm not sure if you write about that, but the Golden Drumstick was a chicken restaurant, which eventually became the Middle Path. And you write about both.
I do. Yeah, the Golden Drumstick definitely had its own following. And the owner worked, had a children's show Saturday mornings on Channel 6. And so that was a great way for him to get that in front of kids. And they all wanted to go to the Golden Drumstick and meet Bob Ladding. And when that ran its course, the Housels came in, renovated it, turned it into the Middle Path, and it had its own following. And so depending on the age of the person I'm talking to and kind of their tastes, you know, they'll have really strong memories of one of those restaurants over the other.
And of course, it was a distinctive building because it was built diagonally to the intersection, too.
Yeah, right at 11th and Yale on the northeast corner. There's a service station there now, but it was this great little southwest-looking building, southwest-style building. It's a shame it's gone.
And when you mention the Middle Path, this is what I would say is sort of the innovators that are in the book. And the Middle Path was, I think, Tulsa's first introduction to health food and California southwest health food.
Yeah, they did their own thing. You know, they baked their own bread with a bunch of natural ingredients. They grew their own alfalfa sprouts, which I learned Tom Butcher, who ran Impressions at 15th and Lewis, would go buy his sprouts from the folks at Middle Path. And so it was just another one of those connections between places. And that's probably why Middle Path sits so well with so many people, because it was so different.
And there were a whole list of restaurants. They were innovators in a way. The Razor Clam was, I think, perhaps the first open to the public fine dining. You know, you had the country clubs where you had fine dining, but I think Razor's Clam had to be one of the very first fine dining experiences in the Tulsa. That was Rick Camp.
Right. The Razor Clam, Rick Camp ran it, and it had a couple of owners over its history, and it was an experience unlike any other. Rick called it an expense account restaurant because you'd have all the oil executives come in and pay good money. They had their own Leon Russell story, which a lot of places like to talk about Leon because he was very popular in town. But it continued that tradition that started with places like the Louisiane and the Villa Venice of, you know, here's something a little bit extra. With Tulsa being an oil town, it did really well when the oil industry was doing well. But when it crashed in 86, the Razor Clam was gone shortly after.
Yeah, you mentioned the Villa Venice. That would be one of Tulsa's first power public restaurants, I would think. I would think the clubs, you know, the Petroleum Club and the Tulsa Club were like that in its own way. But for public restaurants, probably Villa Venice was Tulsa's first power restaurant, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's a great story in and of itself. You have Tommy Alessio, who's this really, like, he had several restaurants in Tulsa. In fact, he's credited with introducing Tulsa to pizza as a dish, you know, because that didn't come back to the United States until after World War II. And people would see it on the menu, they wouldn't buy it, so he ended up having it as an appetizer at his restaurant La Scala on 11th, just to get it in front of people. But Villa Venice was his baby. That was like the big thing that he worked towards. And getting to talk to his daughter about the history of that and how much that meant to Tommy and the family, you know, it's just a wonderful story of someone putting everything they have in that restaurant. And when Tommy left, even though the restaurant was open for a few more years after that, you know, it just wasn't the same because it wasn't Alessio.
Yeah. And he had that sort of reputation where you have power brokers saying, hey, we're going to build a golf course at La Fortune Park. We want you to run the restaurant there.
Right. Yeah, he did that. He had the patio grill at the par 3 golf course on Lewis, which he later sold to waitress Goldie Crow, which is Goldie's that Tulsa's right. known now. And when Country Club Plaza was being built, they said, hey, we want this to be you. We want you to put your restaurant in it and be an anchor for us. And, you know, what a great honor.
Yeah. But it was a restaurant like that where movers and shakers made deals where it was their expense account restaurant. It was the first one like that.
Yeah. And Villa Venice, you know, they would completely shut down the second floor when the petroleum exhibition was in town because they'd rent the whole place out.
Yeah. Another story, this is short-lived restaurant, but still has a lot of people who remember it fondly, and that was My Pie.
Yes. I had to make a decision real early to avoid chain restaurants when at all possible. But there are a couple in here that are not Tulsa-based that came to Tulsa and had a big impact, like Casa Bonita, and My Pie is another one of those, where Larry Aronson in Chicago started My Pie Pizza, decided he was going to franchise them and open a few of them up. Tulsa's was the third location, and most Tulsans had never experienced deep dish pizza before. And boy, it made an impact. And that one gets a lot of comments from folks when I bring it up.
Yeah. The decision to include chains, what made you say, for example, Shotgun Sam's, that's in there? You mentioned Casa Bonita. There are a few other chains in there. What was the criteria for including it or not?
Well, if it started in Tulsa, like Shotgun Sam's, I figured it was fair game. Or if it came to Tulsa and just had such an impact that people kept mentioning it to me, I figured there had to be something to it, and it was part of the fabric of Tulsa, even though it wasn't started here, like Casa Bonita, like Crystal's Pizza, like My Pie. These are places that, you know, came into Tulsa but became so beloved by the residents that I had to include them.
Of course, drive-ins are a big part of Tulsa's heritage, and when anybody thinks of drive-ins, they think of Pennington's, but there were many others, too. So what were the standouts for you that you wanted to write about?
Well, Pennington's, of course, was number one. That's the one that gets mentioned to me more than anything else. Miller's Drive-In on Admiral was another one that was mentioned to me a lot, and turns out that was a Pennington's at one point in its life. Boots Drive-In on Sheridan was one that
I... That was a story I never heard of, but it sounds like it's a great story.
Oh, it's wonderful, because you have the owner, Basil Blackburn, that owned it for most of its life, later went on to work at the Argentina Steakhouse, and he had the Steakfinger House downtown, and he retired just a couple of years ago in his 80s. And Boots was really popular with the Hale kids, so after football games, they had to have their own police officers come out and direct traffic and make sure, you know, things were on the up and up. But it was getting to talk to Basil about that and then learning about Bob Boots, who started the drive-in. He has a connection to Route 66, which is something else that's very near and dear to my heart. And that was really amazing to put those pieces together.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Boots was sort of the hangout for Hale kids. Was Pennington's the hangout for Edison kids? Did every school have its own sort of hangout?
Every school kind of did. Pennington's breaks the mold a little because everyone would come from around town to go to Pennington's. That would either be the start or the end of their trip on the Restless Ribbon. And so that one had an impact on a lot of people. But you also had the stretch on Admiral, which was Cotton's and Norman Angel's and Miller's, which was Pennington's before that, Jack Horner's. They had their own chain for folks that went up to Rogers and places like that. And one of the greatest little tidbits that I got from this book that has nothing to do with the restaurant specifically is back then when kids were cruising, they'd have their own honk pattern for whatever school they went to. So if they drove by Pennington's, they'd honk their car a certain way to say, I'm from Hale or I'm from Central. And if they had any buddies that were parked, they'd hear that same honk echoed back to them. And that's something that's totally lost today.
Wow, that's amazing. That's right. Well, everybody has cell phones now.
Right.
We text. My guest today is Reese Martin. He's a photographer and writer and the author of Lost Restaurants of Tulsa. Beautiful book, lots of pictures, but also wonderful stories about this heyday of restaurants. I feel lucky that I managed to eat in most of these restaurants, but there are definitely a few I missed. Of the ones that you wrote about, which is the one you really wish you'd had a chance to have a meal in?
Boy, I would say Bishop's first, just because it was so integral to that time in Tulsa's history, and they had a lot to pick from, so I'd be able to go through that whole menu, and it'd take me a while. But other than that, maybe Kay's Diner, because Kay's on 31st, when I would talk to people about it or read old articles, it was like, you know, like the food is, they're not offering something that other people don't offer. It's chicken fried steak, rolls, mashed potatoes, but everything is just good. And it felt like the kind of place that I'd walk in, they'd know my order and start fixing it before I even sat down. Those are the two that stand out to me boy, I sure wish I could have had a chance.
Well, I ate at both Kay's and Ruby's later. And it is mystery to me why there's not a restaurant at that location now, because it's perfect. It's right off the BA. You know, you just pop right in. But for whatever reason, it's not a restaurant anymore.
Yeah, they're waiting for the right person, I guess.
That's right. You mentioned Al's Hickory House. This was an interesting thing because, you know, when Al's Hickory House was going, I never went out there, but 81st and Memorial, this was the countryside back then.
Right.
So what was special about Al's Hickory House?
Oh, Al's very interesting because he did that several times. He'd open a restaurant on the edge of town because he wanted to be part of the city but not in the city. Then the city would encroach. And then he'd decide, okay, I'm going to move. And then, okay, now if there's people, I'm going to move again. And so when he moved out to 81st Memorial, he figured the city would never get out there. And so he bought this two-story clapboard house, lived on the second floor, and had a restaurant on the bottom floor. People that came out would come in through the kitchen, and if he didn't like you, that's as far as you got. That's it, out the door. But I got to talk to several people that worked with Al and knew Al, and you know, once you knew him, of course, it was great. You know, he'd weep with happiness when you came in and all this other kind of stuff. And I had the wonderful honor of speaking on the phone with Ron Baber of Ron's Hamburgers. This is one of the first places he worked to learn the trade. Yeah, I was very sad to hear of his passing recently, but he was so generous with, you know, talking to me about it and his experiences at Al's. And it just goes to show you, you never know what impact you're going to have going forward.
Yeah. Do you think the reason it was way out in the sticks was, again, a vestige of liquor laws? You were outside of prying eyes from at least the city, at least, if you still had to worry about the county. You know, Avalon Steakhouse on the west side, again, it was out in no man's land. The original Freddy's Steakhouse out in Drumright was out in the middle of nowhere. A lot of them were out there in the middle of nowhere, and at least in some cases, I don't think Freddy's was the case, but some were there because there was less hassle about serving mixed drinks or alcohol.
Yeah, and with Al's place, you know, lawyers liked it, judges liked it, rock bands that came in to play the Canes would get taken out there. So you know that there were more than their fair share of drinks being served. But because they were outside of the city limits, it wasn't as big of a deal. You know, there's a story in there about Molly Murphy's, which is in the middle of town. And they got raided their grand opening night. So it was something that everybody had to deal with one way or the other. And if you could put yourself a little outside of the system, it'd just be a little less of a headache.
Now, the restaurant I wish I'd eaten at, I have to admit from this book, is Louisiane. I was just too young to go to it in its heyday, but I always would hear announcements on the radio. And my parents would often talk about a special night at the Louisiane. What was special about the Louisiane? This was at 18th and Boston.
Right, yeah, and that building is still there. Yeah. It was what I would consider Tulsa's very first fine dining experience. They would have seafood shipped in from the coast, and I learned that the Kallmeyer family, Herb Kallmeyer that ran it, would only give out new money for change. He would never give out old bills. They really defined themselves on providing a dining experience unlike any other place in town. Food you couldn't get anywhere else. People that came into town for shows and, you know, actors and performers would go to Louisiana because it was a coastal experience in the heart of the country.
Hmm. Were they serving sort of New Orleans fare, or was it fresh seafood, or was it a seafood restaurant?
It was mostly seafood, and then you kind of had it go towards the New Orleans style. When ownership changed in the 1980s, I found an amusing anecdote with a gentleman that talked about the Louisiana style, like blackened chicken and things like that. And like, it's a fad. We're not going to offer it. It's going to go away. And, you know, it also moved a couple of locations in its last few years, but they were primarily a seafood and fine dining, yes.
And really, the mystique of the place was the owner.
Right. Yeah. Herb was very keen on providing an experience that people would feel that, you know, you can't get it by going to Bishop's. You can't get it by going to any of these other places. Herb's son, who I got to talk to, still has a little tiny piano that he received from Liberace, who came in and signed him for people dining there. It was just, you never knew who would walk into the door next.
Well, were there restaurants you wanted to write about but just couldn't find a source? You know, people moved to the Four Winds, maybe families leave town. Was there a couple of restaurants that you just wanted to find information on, but you couldn't find it?
There were several. Borden's Cafeteria was a big one that I had a little bit.
You would think Borden's Cafeteria, that was, where is that, at 2nd and Lewis?
They had like 8 locations at one time.
Oh, right. And there's one on Admiral around Yale, I believe.
Right. And all the restaurants were a little different from each other. And in fact, Crystal's Pizza was originally a Borden's, and it has its own little history. But you know, I either didn't have enough information on places like Borden's or Cardo's Cadillac on 15th Street.
Cardo's Cadillac, yeah.
Sleepy Hollow was another big one I really
Sleepy
wanted to
Hollow,
include.
Yeah.
And then there were a few others that I had some more information, but they just, you know, through the process of editing and, you know, having a limit with the book on how much you can plug in there, Danner's Cafeteria, which was in Utica Square, and a few others that, you know, there's enough there that once I recuperate, I'll be able to start looking at maybe a volume two.
Yeah. Are you thinking about a volume two? Or are you thinking about maybe writing something about Route 66, which sounds like that is a great love for you as well?
It is. Route 66 is a big passion for me. I'm on the Tulsa Route 66 Commission and with a few other groups. So that has occurred to me. But then again, you know, the restaurant thing I expect as I go out for book signings and meet people, I'll find these folks that I was not able to find while researching the first one. And I don't know if I'll be able to resist plugging in and making another volume of this.
No. What's been the reaction to the book so far?
I'm very blessed. It's been very strong.
I would think it would be because there are just so many people who grew up going to these restaurants, or they heard their parents talking about these restaurants if they're a younger age, or experienced some of them. And there's something wonderful about them.
Well, the only thing this town loves more than a new restaurant is an old one. And so, yeah, it's just been wonderful. It's on sale at bookstores across town. Amazon has sold out of it. We're on our third printing, and it just hit the streets on Monday. It just goes to the strength of the stories that the families told me, and how much people are interested in the history of Tulsa.
You know, you mentioned going to Eddie's during their last week, and there's a couple of stories where you write about the closing of the restaurants. I think Metro Diner was one like that. People were really affected by the closings at the time.
And they still are. You know, when I mention Metro Diner as an example, people still just kind of lean back and say, oh, man, I can't believe that they're closed. And they've been gone for over a decade now.
And you still see the sign when you drive by 169 in the Brie.
Yeah, the Stokely Event Center. God bless them for saving that neon. They've got a lot of great signs. And Eddie's, they have their sign too. And there are other restaurants where pieces of them have survived. The Eastside Cafe on Admiral were well known for their onion rings. The Freeway Cafe in town has that recipe and still serve them today. And so there are a few restaurants in the book where you can find elements of it around town if you know where to look.
Yeah. When you mentioned Eddie's, you know, the first time I went to Eddie's, and I've driven by Eddie's many, many, many times, and I'm, you know, it just looked like a fallout shelter.
Right.
And what I was surprised is I'm looking at some of these old restaurants, a lot of them. I mean, it was like concrete bricks, put up a restaurant and start serving food.
Yeah, just something basic. That's why places, I think, like Golden Drumstick, you know, stood out, because here's a building that's specially designed for this. But you know, you'd walk into Eddie's and there are no windows. It's all wood paneling. And even on their last week of business, it felt like you were stepping back into the 1950s.
Yes, indeed.
If you go into the Golden Palace over at 51st in Peoria, it's very similar. They've been there since 79. It's that same family that dates back to the Mandarin. And they have an oil painting over the cash register of Joe King, who was the cook in the Mandarin when they opened in 1930. It's great to see a lot of this still around.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with the book. The name of the book is Lost Restaurants of Tulsa. Reese, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Writer, photographer, and Route 66 advocate Reese Martin is the author of the new book, Lost Restaurants of Tulsa. He has several signings in the next several days here in the Tulsa area, tonight at 6 o'clock at Ida Red downtown, a rescheduled signing at the Tulsa Historical Society, originally for Saturday. It is now Monday evening at 6:30 at the Historical Society, and the following evening at Magic City Books. That begins at 7. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.